Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Arts education is among the greatest casualties during distance learning, but a Sacramento nonprofit is working to close that gap. I spent the day at Clara Classrooms, which is offering virtual performing arts to 250,000 children for free. Plus, Washington Post political columnist Karen Tumulty joins us. She discusses her new book, The Triumph of Nancy Reagan, a biography showing how she became one of the most influential first ladies of the century. And May is Bike Month. We'll explain why it's more than just fun social events, but also changing the transportation landscape. This also comes as the bicycling industry is booming during the pandemic. But is this just a spontaneous splurge or something more? We're going to head to the country's cycling capital, which is also in our backyard, for some answers. But first, what is meant to be the wet season in California is coming to a close, and really, it's just not good. The first 6 months of the water year rank as the fourth driest on record, and this already follows a largely dry 2020. So what exactly does this mean? Chris Orok with California Department of Water Resources explains the impact one of the driest water years on record will have on the state. Chris, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicky.
Well, Chris, I guess just starting off pretty simply, how bad is it?
Well, you know, we actually have to go back 2 years, in the last 2 years, since October 1st of 2019. And October 1st is the start of our water year, so that's what we go back to. We're in our second driest period on record. Only 1976 and 1977 are drier two-year periods. In fact, we've received less precipitation in the last 2 years than what we normally get in a one-year period.
Wow. You know, this, as you mentioned, this is the second dry year in a row. And how does that impact or worsen this year?
Well, we don't have any carryover. If we look back just really 2 years ago to 2019, which was our fifth best snowpack in California history, on this date in 2019, our snowpack was at 141% of average. Today, we're at 17% of average. Now, that snowpack is really important because that's our frozen reservoir. That's about 30% of our fresh water supply in California on a regular year. Well, last year, we were able to withstand the dry conditions because we had the carryover from that really good 2019. We didn't get any carryover this year. So our reservoirs are starting to show the impacts of that and are well below average. In fact, our runoff, because it was so dry last year, instead of when the snow melts, it running off into the streams and rivers and then down into our reservoirs, the ground's actually absorbing a lot of that because it was so dry before the storms came. And speaking of those storms, once again, back in 2019, we had 40 atmospheric rivers in 2019 alone. The last 2 years, we've only had three.
Wow. What does this mean for water allocations? I mean, when talking about reservoirs.
Yeah, well, our water allocations right now for the State Water Project are at 5%. We started out at 10% earlier this year, and they were reduced down to 5%. They reassess them on a monthly basis. I don't know if it's going to change at all for the rest of the year, but, you know, California is a Mediterranean climate. We see periods like this, and you and I have spoken before. It's not if, it's when that next drought's coming. And the governor 2 weeks ago declared a drought emergency for two counties in California, and he said we're going to continue to watch conditions and reassess as we move forward. And you know, I would expect that to expand to other counties as we continue into these dry, warm summer months.
And that brings up a good point. I think it's a good reminder. What would constitute a declaration of drought from the governor?
Well, there's a lot of factors that go into that, and you know, it's water supply. The lake he was at last week or 2 weeks ago, Lake Mendocino, where he was standing 2 years ago, he would have been under 40 feet of water, and it was bare dry where he was standing 2 weeks ago. So, you know, in California, we always have drought-like conditions somewhere in the state because of the type of climate we have. Really, we only get the majority of our rain and snow over a 3 or 4 month period, December through sometimes the end of March, but really December through February. We don't get that much rain or any snow after usually April, and definitely not during the summer months. So, you know, it's that supply factor that we have moving forward and where we're at as far as each community is a little different. Are you supplied by a large reservoir, or is it a small stream of wells that you're supplied by? And that adds into a lot of other factors that they're looking at.
What did we learn from the 2012-2016 drought that we can apply now?
Well, there's a lot of things that we took from that, a lot of history that we've learned just in, you know, the residents of California really have stepped up at the end of that drought and continued, and anywhere between, I think, 19 and 25% overall reduction in water use since that last drought, and continued even during those wet years. So it's making little small changes in your daily habits of not having to water every day, your lawn, you know, only using your dishwasher and washing machine when they're full. But then we also look at agriculture, and agriculture, the industry really has stepped up, and the innovation and water efficiency and how they use water has really improved over the last couple of years from those lessons that they learned in the last drought.
Yeah, California has some of the most extreme weather patterns in the country, in the continental United States, and we've known that for quite some time. But how does modeling and technology need to improve to measure this more accurately on the long term?
Well, that's one of our largest difficulties, is the technology we have now and able to look out. We're really only accurate 10 to 14 days in the future as far as how we could see incoming storms and be able to forecast them with really good accuracy. We can see a little farther out, but, you know, the problem we have in California is that high pressure system. That high pressure system sits off our coast and forces all the storms that come in through the Pacific to either go north or southwest. They're out there. The storms are there. They want to come and bring rain to California. The high pressure system just sits there and doesn't allow that. So there's not that much we could do about that. What we look at is how we can more efficiently use the water that we do get on an annual basis. And there's a lot of factors that go into what that water is used for: environmental, agriculture, recreation, and residential use. So all that works together, and we use the water that we get from Mother Nature to the most efficient way that we can.
Chris Orok is with California Department of Water Resources. Thank you for joining us on Insight this morning.
Thanks, Vicki. Anytime.
Up next, Washington Post political columnist Karem Tumulty discusses her new biography on First Lady Nancy Reagan. She explains how the Reagans are more than just a Hollywood love story, especially when it comes to politics. Plus, free virtual arts classes for 250,000 students across Sacramento County school districts. I stop by Clara Classrooms and see how this is possible. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're getting a new look at a Californian political force, First Lady Nancy Reagan. 40 years after Ronald Reagan was sworn into office as the 40th president of the United States, Washington Post political columnist Karem Tumulty detailed the love story of the Reagans, married for over 50 years. But Karen also revealed so much more about the First Lady, who shaped one of the most consequential presidencies of the 20th century. An unassuming influence and power that really is unique to Nancy Reagan as First Lady. A pivotal and crucial piece behind the scenes shaping the President Reagan that history remembers today. I spoke with Karen yesterday, and I started off by asking her why the made-in-Hollywood marriage of Ronald and Nancy Reagan is more than a love story.
I think she was way overdue for a reassessment here. The degree to which she really was a partner, both, you know, the incredibly instrumental role that she played in sort of constructing the scaffolding for his rise, you know, doing so much of the networking, which, by the way, was not something that came naturally to Ronald Reagan. The degree to which she was a real influence in his White House, as I write in the book, she didn't set foot in the West Wing very often, but when she was not happy about something, they all knew it. And people who were not in her favor tended not to last very long. And as a result, she really had an influence, not just on, she would say, oh, just people issues. But in fact, I mean, come on, anybody who's been around politics knows that if you can influence who is in the room when there's a decision to be made or advice to be given, you can have a big influence on the outcome. And certainly we see that in Soviet policy. We see that in a lot of areas. And then finally, when he is so shortly after his presidency, you know, is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, it really falls on her shoulders to really shape the legacy.
What surprised me is that, or I guess it was just such an intimate kind of finding that you had, was that she was the only person in the world to whom Ronald Reagan felt truly close to.
That's right. And she would say, sometimes even I feel that barrier. He himself would say, I've never had trouble making friends, but there's always a part of myself that I hold back. He was a very solitary figure. Really, she was the only person, quite literally, in the whole world that he needed. And, you know, the sort of tragic part here is their bond was just so close that it shut out everyone, including, you know, their own children.
Her confidence, you mentioned in the book, was a product of a traumatic childhood, and you go in depth about that. How did her childhood shape the woman that history remembers her as?
It starts with her being abandoned for 6 years by her mother when she's very young. Her mother was an ambitious actress. Her parents' marriage blows up. Actually, it was pretty much over by the time she arrived. So this child spends 6 years just yearning for this absent mother. And, you know, as her son Ron told me, you know, it really cast a shadow on her spirit, an insecurity that never lifted. You know, this sense that no matter how good things are, the bottom could drop out at any moment. And that would certainly seem to be almost confirmed when she almost loses her husband 2 months into his presidency to an assassin's bullet. But her mother ultimately comes back, marries a neurosurgeon, takes young Nancy to Chicago. But there you can also see in her mother's marriage a lot of the patterns of the Reagan's marriage, because her adoptive father, who she adored, was kind of a distant, remote figure. And it really was Edith, her mother, who was the networker of the two. The other thing about Ronald Reagan is everyone knows, a very famously detached manager, but he was also just totally conflict averse. He really felt like you hire good people, you trust them to do a good job. He was very generous with second chances and third chances. For Nancy, it was the opposite. You know, trust was to be earned, not given, and withdrawn at the first sight. And so she really had a much better, as James Baker, their first White House chief of staff, told me, she had much better instincts than he did, and especially about people. She just had a much better nose for trouble.
Did she pioneer or just contribute to a kind of new era or chapter of strength for women in politics during that time?
She would absolutely say no, and she would absolutely reject any idea that she was any kind of a feminist. But I do think, I mean, every first lady sort of has to adapt the role to her circumstances and to her spouse and his needs. I think she was the ideal partner for Ronald Reagan, and she did exercise power in a way, silently, often without leaving any fingerprints, but in a way no first lady before or since really has.
What surprised you most during the more than 4 years of personal interviews and research?
I think it really was the degree to which she influenced policies in ways we do not associate with any first lady, much less this supposedly very traditional one. And that is why I opened the book with a story that George Shultz, who was their Secretary of State and who found her just an invaluable ally against a lot of the hardliners and hawks in the administration, a story he told me about how she really was the one who opened the door to the warming of relations with Moscow. And I think that, you know, that is just such a, primarily not because she had any great geostrategic sense, but because she didn't want her husband to go down in history as a warmonger. She knew this made sense politically. You know, sometimes she would have to, they would have big arguments. The Reagans were a real married couple, so they would have real arguments. And she would like try and get him to sort of pull back on his rhetoric. She hated this famous phrase of his, evil empire, to describe the Soviet Union. But it, I mean, she was a real influence on all of that. And I think I have that just very, you know, I have it documented. It's airtight.
You described the Reagan presidency as tumultuous. You know, this year really marks the 40-year anniversary of President Reagan's inaugural term as president. So can you just remind us of the political climate and challenges at that time?
Certainly. I mean, if you can imagine, I mean, he gets elected in a landslide in 1980. He gets elected in a bigger landslide in 1984. If you can imagine any candidate today who could win 49 states. But by 1986, his presidency is hit by scandal, one that could have led to his impeachment, the Iran-Contra affair. It involves trading arms to Iran as ransom payment for hostages, illegal diversions of funds to rebel forces in Central America. Ronald Reagan doesn't want to acknowledge or understand the danger he is in. And it really falls to Nancy to almost single-handedly run the rescue operation, to force him against his will finally into shaking up the White House staff and getting rid of his chief of staff, and ultimately to force him to acknowledge to the country, and just as importantly, acknowledge to himself that he has, in fact, this was no diplomatic overture to Iran, that he, in fact, was paying ransom for hostages. As much as he denied it, as much as it was in, you know, violation of every policy he said he did, and, you know, sort of getting him to the place where he could do that was, I think, crucial to the survival of his presidency.
You're talking about an influence that shaped the president's rhetoric and the choice of White House advisors. Is there another first lady with that similar impact?
You know, I think she, in this sense, she was, you know, unique. And in her fearlessness about doing this, she was unique. But also that Ronald Reagan himself was unique. I mean, most of our presidents, if you look at Bill Clinton or H.W. or even Donald Trump, you know, sitting there on the phone all day long, talking to advisors, it was just that Reagan was an isolated and remote figure. And so in that sense, he really did need someone there watching his back. And that is what she did.
Coming full circle, you know, the biography is described as more than a love story. And we're clearly learning that when it comes to Nancy Reagan. But ultimately, was there more? They were married for more than 50 years. Ultimately, was their marriage anchored in love?
It absolutely, absolutely was. And I sort of explain, I mean, love, though, is partly chemistry. So I did try to sort of explore what it was that brought these two people together at a moment in their life when both of them are kind of scraping bottom in Hollywood, and nobody could have imagined what lay ahead for the two of them. And, you know, so sort of what it was that made this bond so tight. The other thing that is really, you know, you've got to mention is she was a very controversial first lady. I mean, she made a lot of mistakes. She brought a lot of her troubles upon herself. So as shrewd as she was about managing his image, she was just clueless about her own in many ways.
Karen Tumulty is a political columnist with The Washington Post and the author of the new biography, The Triumph of Nancy Reagan. Our conversation was recorded yesterday. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we were learning more about a new biography on former First Lady in California, Nancy Reagan. Now we're going to get our creative juices flowing and moving. In response to digital learning, arts and physical activity really took a backseat. The nonprofit Clara in Sacramento noticed the gap and created a new virtual teaching artist residency with a focus on accessibility, really meeting students, teachers, and families where they are. The program is called Clara Classroom, stocked with learning modules and lesson plans with a focus to get children out of their seats and moving and accessing their creativity. What's really incredible about this program is that it's incredibly free, thanks to funding from other nonprofits and private donors. It started last fall within Sacramento City Unified Classrooms. It's now expanding to all districts within Sacramento County. We're talking 250,000 students. And they're even hoping to reach even more schools and continue these free classes well beyond the pandemic. Last week, I visited the E. Claire Raley Studios for the Performing Arts, housed at the historic Fremont School in Midtown Sacramento, where artist Casua Yang was recording the latest lesson plan alongside Clara Classroom program creator Emily Danz and executive director Megan Weigand.
Scene 5.
So my name is Casua Yang.
Hi, welcome to class number 4.
I'm a professional Bollywood dancer. I have been doing this professionally for the past 20 years.
You're going to have a lot of fun. So go ahead and take off your shoes, take off your socks, and let's get started. All right, so we're going to start with our legs apart. Make sure that our toes are facing each other.
For me, in a way, when I was younger, when I was a kid starting out, you know, just dancing, I felt like it was kind of like it opened me up. Like it was like my safe haven.
And we are going to be stretching like this and like that.
Definitely something that kids need to try new things and see where and what is their safe haven.
Megan Weigand. I'm the executive director of Clara.
What's happening inside right now?
So we are filming the next set of modules for Clara Classroom, which is our digital platform for arts education. This project started during distance learning last year when we realized that obviously in distance learning, the arts, which are first of all seen as an in-person subject and also not as a subject that teachers often are challenged to include, when teachers have limited education time, the arts are being dropped out. And so we set out to create this digital platform, as you see, where we have video recordings of these very interactive art forms. In this case, what you're seeing today is Bollywood dance being taught.
The parallel, we're just gonna do a couple of squats, so then we're gonna warm up our legs.
Last year, we did some hip hop, we did theater games, we did drumming. This year, we're doing Bollywood, we are doing African Caribbean dance, and we are doing, Ballet Folklorico. And first of all, the idea is that these grow. It's not that those three classes are all you get this year. You also have access to Clara Classroom from the past, and then the new modules will expand upon that learning. The modules are developed so that kids learn the styles and then go away from their computer and play with their classmates or their neighbors or their family. And it's made so that also the teachers with study guides and with teaching guides have the tools to sort of interact with their classroom. Because it is online, we are able to put some metrics into it so that teachers can look at their class roster and see, you know, how far are kids getting in it, what are kids interested in, what are kids going back and seeing again and again and again. And it gives some guidance for how to engage the kids with the arts.
Yeah, I was noticing they were discussing that, you know, they were talking to children whether they were at home or in the classroom.
Yes.
So it's really kind of meeting the student where they are because everyone comes from different circumstances.
Exactly. And, you know, we always saw this. This was, in our mind, an immediate response to the pandemic. But there is also an ongoing problem of arts education in the classroom. About, you know, pre-pandemic, about 35% of Sacramento County students had the state-mandated amount of dance, music, and theater during their school day. And when you look at the studies, students who have arts access do better in school. So this is really an equity issue. This is a student achievement issue. And by creating these modules that are easy, are flexible, we can assign this as homework, you can assign this in the class. It's meant to be something long-term that is a low barrier entry point to just ensure that every child gets the basics.
That was just so staggering when you said 35% of students locally here in Sacramento. If you can just expand upon that, we had a little bit of a breeze, but it's such a sobering number that I think needs to really strike listeners.
Right. I mean, these are statistics that are on, you know, there's several county education websites, there's arts education websites, and these are just the statistics that exist. At the high school level, kids are more likely to have access to the arts. But one of the things that happens is if you go K through six having not had an art program, you get into high school and now you're expected to be in band, but you don't have the tools and you haven't been taught that arts are interesting and fun, and you don't have that willingness to try. And so there's a huge importance about getting early education arts access. But our programming, as we're currently creating it, really is K through 12, so that our idea is every child has access to the arts.
It's also great that it's making it equitable, right? Because arts can cost money at times.
Yes.
And you started off at Sacramento City Unified, but you've now expanded this countywide. And there are several school districts within Sacramento County. About 250,000 students could benefit from this or will benefit from this, and it's free.
Exactly. So, yeah, 250,000 students in Sacramento County's 13 school districts. And just talking about costs, you know, we do in-class residencies, and the average cost for a 10-week residency is about $100 a child. Just, you know, there's teaching artist time, there's staff time, there's a lot of factors that go into that. The cost for Clara Classroom is $1 a child. So when you think about, you know, this year, through several generous donors, we've been able to offer it for free for a limited period of time. But when you think about how a school district that is cash-strapped can find the resources to bring arts into the classroom, this is a much lower barrier to entry. And then the hope is that teachers bring the arts into their classroom, they see how their students respond, they see the value of the arts, and that helps us make the arts a priority for funding, for support, and for expansion. And so soon, every child really will have access to an in-person experience of the arts.
And just expanding upon that, this is a product of responding to the pandemic and distance learning and Zoom classrooms and Google classrooms. But there is a long-term plan once we round this corner and this is behind us, that this access to arts education will be available across all levels, socioeconomic levels.
Yes, exactly. I mean, again, it's an equity issue. When you're at a more well-funded school, the PTA often fundraises for the arts. They see that that's a priority. But if you are at a school where the parents don't have the resources to fundraise, they don't have the time because they're working multiple jobs, the arts are one of those things. They're seen as an elective, not an essential. And, you know, the generation that is now parents also grew up in a school system without the arts, so they don't necessarily understand the importance of it. So we really do see a socioeconomic divide. That 35% of students is almost certainly a higher economic bandwidth. And so for us, making this affordable to all really is an equity issue because, as I said again, the arts are directly tied to student engagement and student achievement. And if we can't make sure that every child can achieve and can succeed, then we really do have a major problem.
Right, because we just learned just through the pandemic that, you know, with distance learning, education is one piece, it's an overarching piece, but a big part of that is the emotional well-being
of a child.
You know, the arts are about social emotional learning because they're about interaction. One of the things about performing arts, again, you know, you aren't doing it alone. You're doing it as a partner with the person on the screen, as a partner with the person next to you. So you really are pushing those children to practice those interactive skills that will make them, as adults, more successful in the workforce. It prioritizes collaboration, it prioritizes interaction, it prioritizes communication, also learning nonverbal communication. You know, if you think about dancing and theater, it's really specifically about becoming attuned to what body language is telling you. So all of those skills are things that the arts build on, and quite frankly, it's one of those things that, because Clara's mission is about arts education, we're not about specific mastery in one given art form. We are about really prioritizing those social and emotional skills and those long-term, you know, really just making more functional, capable, successful young adults. And so our programming is designed so that the child is encouraged to interact with others. So once you learn this dance move, go show your parents. Find a friend and show them the dance step. We specifically have built the platform so that kids can film themselves doing their dances and upload it just to their classroom so that their peers can see and engage with them doing the work. So sort of at all steps, just because of who Clara is and what we believe in terms of arts education, our tools are really prioritizing that social and emotional engagement. Also worth mentioning, these modules were deliberately chosen to be active, physical forms of activity, recognizing that in the last year, kids have been really sedentary. So we're meeting all of the art standards for their age group, but we are also meeting physical education standards.
In the past year, because this started in fall at Sac City Unified, yeah. Correct? Mm-hmm. And now it's expanding countywide for all children. What have been your biggest aha moments with these virtual classrooms?
Well, one of the biggest ones for me, you know, we always talk about how pre-pandemic studies showed on the days that you had arts, you had fewer kids calling in sick, you had a lower rate of absenteeism. And what teachers said at Sac City Unified in the fall was they would lose kids at lunch. So you might log into Zoom in the morning, you do your class, you take a break for lunch, and the kids wouldn't come back. And so a few teachers started putting Clara Classroom in the afternoon, and the kids came back. And so really using the arts as an incentive for attendance. And it felt like a much more immediate thing than sort of having a general data stream that says we do dance on Wednesdays and 15% less kids call out sick on Wednesdays. This was immediate and direct. So that was the biggest takeaway, was really seeing that the arts do incentivize attendance and engagement. The other thing that was kind of exciting was hearing from teachers saying, we want arts in the classroom. We know that arts are important. We don't have the tools to bring the arts to the classroom because we didn't grow up with arts, but this gives us everything we need. So that was really exciting. And then the last thing that was particularly exciting was right at the end of the fall, we got permission instead of, before this, we were sort of rolling it out classroom by classroom where we'd train the teachers about how to use it, and the teachers would either assign it as homework or do it during their distance learning. And at the end of the fall, we were able to put it on Sac City Unified student portal so that the students could directly access it. And we were not prepared. We were not prepared for the passion these kids had for the arts, because it said, you know, this is an arts tool. And in one day, we had 1,000 signups. You know, the kids were like desperately signing up. Our phone numbers are there as a, you know, assuming that the teachers are needing tech support, and suddenly our phones are blowing up with like a 10-year-old trying to get access to their dance class, which was, I mean, just funny, but also endearing, and just the enthusiasm and then the need, the primal need for arts and expression was so clear to us in that moment.
Now, the foundation has been laid out at Sac City Unified, but now that it's expanding, there's several school districts that can benefit. What do they need to know to incorporate this into their classrooms?
Absolutely. So the visual and performing arts lead at every district has been instructed about how Clara Classroom can roll out. One of the things that we've been struggling with is, of course, right now the teachers are all deeply overwhelmed. Everybody is transitioning back to in-person learning. I know that there is not one more tool that you can take on right now. And yet at the same time, It's free right now. We are actively fundraising to make it free for another year. But right now, we have it free through the end of the summer. So we want to get the teachers engaged. We want to get the students their access. Some districts are putting it on the Clever portal so that the students can just access it directly. But having parents and teachers directly reaching out to their visual and performing arts lead, directly advocating for that access and for that information in this sort of information overload era is useful. And that's why we're putting the word out, is that we know that the message that free arts is now available is getting lost in back to school, in, you know, this transition from digital to in-person learning again. And so we really are trying to get that message out because it's important and it's worth their time and it is worth every student's investment.
Is it, does it matter if it's a public or a private school, or if you're just a family at home that's listening to this in the county that's interested?
So our funding is for public schools. That's just the way it is. That's the 250,000 students that we're counting. There are absolutely ways for individual families to access it. We are working with Sac County Office of Education for homeschooling. So if there is an individual family that has a question, I would say go to claraclassroom.org and reach out to the contact info there, and we can find a way to help.
All right, so go ahead and start off sitting down like this. We're going to be stretching our arms out. So go ahead and put this arm out.
My name is Emily Danz, and I'm the Education Outreach Director at Clara.
How did this all come together?
So last year, when the pandemic began, we had a number of different teaching artists who were in schools teaching all sorts of different disciplines in music, theater, and dance, and those all got very abruptly shut down, along with schools being shut down in terms of being in person. And so we wanted to find a way to still provide that teaching artist experience for students, knowing that they were likely going to be learning from home. So we pulled some of our teaching artists who were currently in our schools and created a series of video lessons so that kids could access these at any time on their own schedule in any location. And we really wanted to plan these videos to be not something that was just a temporary fix during the pandemic, but a resource that could be used for years to come. And so we invested a lot of time and resources and energy to build out a curriculum that was aligned to the California art standards, so that it was curriculum that would be aligned with the standards that are needed in our public school system, and can be accessed individually by students at home or in a classroom setting with the whole group together.
I mean, it's quite elaborate. What kind of undertaking was this?
So last year when we started, we were working with very minimal resources. It was me recording on a phone in our space at Clara, with no professional lighting or sound or camera equipment or editing equipment. And we're really lucky a year later to be filming new course modules to add to the platform, with a videographer and a sound engineer and professional lighting. So we're making some advancements now, but when we got started, it was a lot of effort done by a very few number of people to put this together.
You know, when you think about teachers and parents juggling so much over the past year, you know, what's so great about this is you're kind of creating a very manageable syllabus and framework for families and for teachers who are already juggling a lot.
Exactly. And the goal really was to teach the content through a video setting, because that is now how we are accessing a lot of education materials. But once the students learn the material in the video, our hope is that they then take it away from their screens and can practice their music rhythms, their dance moves, their theater games with family members, friends, neighbors, other classmates. So it's really to give them some creative tools to use away from their screen. And yeah, everything is delivered by the teaching artist in the video. So there's no pressure for parents to be involved or have to have a hand in it. The classroom teachers don't need to be responsible for learning how to do any of these art forms. Everything is delivered through the instructor in the videos.
And I know you're currently recording one right now. How many classrooms or how many lesson plans are already available?
So there are currently 5 different course modules on the platform, and we are, yes, currently today filming one of 3 new course modules that will be added in the coming school year. So we are looking at specifically addressing the fact that kids have been sitting and sedentary for a really long time this past year. So our new course modules really emphasize physical activity and getting kids up and moving. And also representing the really culturally diverse landscape that we have in Sacramento. So being able to represent the students that we serve through some different cultural art forms. So today we are filming a module in Bollywood dance and bringing the a variety of different Indian dance forms together in this Bollywood course to expose kids to some forms of dance and art that they wouldn't typically get in a public school setting.
Finally, over the past year with this endeavor, what are the most touching moments that stick with you?
That's a great question. I think it has introduced art to kids who never had access before. And so hearing the response and the enthusiasm from kids who see this new application or icon on their classroom platform and the excitement that they have about being able to engage in these styles of movement and theater and music that they otherwise wouldn't have access, whether they couldn't afford access or they didn't have it offered at their schools. So enthusiasm in just being able to participate in the arts at such a huge scale is really exciting. Seeing that it's increasing engagement for classroom teachers has been a really positive benefit.
All right, you guys, that was a great warm up. If you need to stretch out any other parts of your body, feel free to. I would highly suggest that if you are still tight on your thighs or your shoulder, go ahead and stretch that out. We are gonna go to our skill video.
And that was artist Kajua Yang, Clara Classroom Program Creator Emily Danz, and Executive Director Megan Weigand. Still ahead, bike sales have skyrocketed during the pandemic. We'll check in with the mecca of cycling in the United States, UC Davis, and get you up to speed on May is Bike Month. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A year into the pandemic, the bicycle industry is still booming. So much so that finding a bike for cyclists became just really a stressful search with back orders lasting months. But are these simply fleeting, spontaneous buys, or is the cycling demand and community changing long term? For that and more, we're going to head to the cycling capital of the U.S., Davis. The city actually has the most bikes per capita in the country. Appropriately, Dylan Fitch is a professional researcher as well as the co-director of the Bicycling Plus Research Collaborative at UC Davis. We're also joined by Deborah Banks, executive director of Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, because May is Bike Month. Welcome to Insight, Deborah and Dylan.
Thank you.
Well, thanks.
Well, Dylan, we'll start off with you. Bike sales and even e-bike sales have really skyrocketed over the past year. Does this actually mean it's going to likely lead to more bicycling?
Well, we're studying that. I think that having bikes in people's homes is the first step, right? And so, especially e-bikes, because we know that e-bikes tend to kind of get people out of cars a little more so than conventional bikes. So I think that we have to wait and see, but it's very encouraging that, you know, the demand just has gone up so much.
You know, I've been learning a lot about micro mobility. So that's, you know, bicycles, e-bikes, electric scooters, electric skateboards, shared bicycles, and all of that. What is the role of micro mobility services post-pandemic as life is beginning to return to normal?
Yeah, micromobility services are a hot topic right now in policy and research, and it's clear that pre-pandemic, they really kind of opened people's eyes to alternative ways of moving around their cities. So, for example, we have research that shows in the Sacramento region, awareness of e-bikes almost doubled when the Jump bike system, after it was introduced. So now it's more than just the new vehicles, though. It's also about whether these kind of services stick as regular travel modes. And I think that's still to be seen. But the demand for especially scooter share is just going up and up and up in cities across the world. So I don't think it's going to disappear. I think it's more about how cities can really make it a viable solution for getting around.
Right before the pandemic, you were conducting a study on Jump bikes in Yolo and Sacramento County. And as we know, during the pandemic, they just kind of disappeared. You know, people weren't using shared biking transportation, or even public transportation had a significant drop. So I guess, how are these bike share services evolving now?
Yeah, so there was this fear that a private run bike share, scooter share could just back out when the economics weren't there, and we saw that happen in many places. So I think it forces cities to go back to reevaluate whether this is something they really want, then maybe they need to invest in it and protect it a little bit. And so we used to have models where cities had more control over these services, whether they were owned by the city or operated by a nonprofit. These were common ways to operate a bike share. I think that maybe there's a medium between a privately run bike share and scooter share, but that the city has more control over whether it can leave or not. But I think the cities need to put some investment into it. Otherwise, the companies can't survive.
Deborah, May is Bike Month, and as the executive director of Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, why is it important?
Well, you know, May is Bike Month has been in the works since 1956, which is a long time. And the whole idea of it is to encourage people to leave their car in the garage and jump on their bike, whether it's an e-bike or not, and do a daily trip. Go to the grocery store, go to a bakery, go to a coffee shop, ride your bike to Folsom. You know, make it long, make it short, but get out and use your bicycle. And so organizations all around the city, including Sava, have activities going on to help encourage people to do that. There's swag to be earned. There's Energizer pop-up activities all around the city happening. And it's really a celebration of all things bicycle for the whole month of May.
Well, as a result of the pandemic, SABA, Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, you launched Cycle Bike Match. And it's a really cool program connecting essential workers who need a bike, making sure they get a bike. So how is it going?
Yeah, it's sort of like being a bike yenta, if you will. The idea is that there are, as Dylan said, you know, a huge shortage of bicycles, and the supply chain for bicycles throughout the whole bicycle industry is slowed down to a crawl. And that's because of the pandemic and shipping out of China and Asia predominantly. So there are a lot of people, though, that have bicycles that are sitting in their garage that they're either not using or they've left and are using a newer, fancier bicycle. So all of those other bicycles can be put into use. We take those bicycles in. We work with a SAC Bike Kitchen. So we're in partnership with them. We wrench those bikes, make sure that they're in great working order, and then we match them up with somebody else and get them on the road so they can enjoy May's Bike Month and or use them for daily transportation or exercise, especially during the pandemic. It's been a really fulfilling project and program for us.
Dylan Fitch is a professional researcher and co-director of the UC Davis Bicycling Plus Research Collaborative, and Deborah Banks is executive director of SABA, Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates. Great having you two on.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or really wherever you listen to your podcasts. Tomorrow, our conversation with Senator Alex Padilla. So if you have any questions, be sure and send them our way. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We're going to catch you back here tomorrow and leave you with May the 4th be with you.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.